Hello, I'm Jeff Sykes, and I'd like to update you on recent developments in the taxation of employee benefits. I'm going to have a look at five areas. Firstly, we'll look at the taxation of cars and other vehicles. We'll look at employee share matters, pension scheme issues. We'll have a run through various other employee benefits and finish off, appropriately enough, with termination payments. Let me then start by having a look at one or two developments in relation to cars and other vehicles. An important change that came in relation to vans provided for employees on the 6th of April 2007. Although this started in April 07, the first year it's in force, of course, is 07-08, so it'll be during the course of 2008 that the P11D forms and so on have to be completed. The major impact of this is that the van benefit, which was previously £500 a year for a van less than 4 years old, goes up to £3,000 for the van and £500 for the fuel. There never was a fuel scale charge before. So many van users will find a sevenfold increase in their benefit in kind charge. At the same time as this increase was being applied, the revenue realised that they should perhaps not penalise people who merely had to take the van home at night and had no other private use of the van. So, as a precursor to these new rules, the revenue brought this rule in, and it now says that if all you ever do with the van is take it home at night, there's no other private use, you won't have one of these benefit in kind charges. Now, moving on from that, the revenue also decided that one or two very small amounts of insignificant private use wouldn't trigger a charge. And they are, perhaps rather amusingly, you're allowed to use the van to take the rubbish to the tip, a slight detour to drop off the kids at school, stop to pick up a newspaper, call in at the dentist. If that's all you do on your way to and from work, then it will not trigger off a van charge. So employers are going to have to be very careful when they do P11Ds in 2008 to make sure these new rules have been taken on board. Next, from April 08, there is an increase in the multiplier for the fuel benefit charge. This is the figure which is multiplied by the percentage which comes from the CO2 emissions of the car. For the first 5 years of the scheme, that was from 03 to 08, it was £14,400. It's now gone up to £16,900. So many employees will see quite a substantial increase in their benefit in kind charge from 08 onwards. Next, the advisory fuel rates for company cars. These are the rates that apply where there's reimbursement. Now, the reimbursement might be one of two ways. It might be where the employer is reimbursing the employee for business travel in the company car. In other words, the car's provided but not the petrol, and they have to pay for the petrol. Or, turning it round the other way, where all the petrol is provided in the company car, but the employee has to reimburse the employer. If he didn't, he'd be liable to a fuel scale benefit charge. So, where these reimbursements take place, there's an official rate that can be used. The revenue emphasised the fact that they don't apply in any other circumstances, only reimbursement cases, and there's no need for a revised dispensation. These just take place automatically. Now, the revenue have been changing these figures at quite regular intervals. They have now announced that they won't change them quite so frequently in future. One cautionary tale that shows what happens where these rules aren't complied with is the impact foiling case, and I'd like to have a look at that. In the impact foiling case, the directors did have company cars, they purchased fuel, and they made a monthly expense claim. And the idea was that they only recovered from the employer fuel for business journeys. And since it was reimbursed for business journeys only, no benefit in kind. Unfortunately, the log that they used was inaccurate, and it turned out they hadn't fully reimbursed the private fuel. Now, the rules actually say the private fuel must be made good in the relevant tax year. The revenue take a slightly relaxed view on that, and if it's done within a few months of the end of the year, they accept that's okay. But a much later reimbursement was completely ineffective, and because this is a cliff edge type charge, a full year scale charge applied to the directors, even though perhaps a relatively small amount of private fuel was not fully reimbursed. So it's a cautionary tale, this is a cliff edge type charge. Another case that emphasises the fact that many of these charges are cliff edge type is an issue about the definition of a car. This was Mr. Morris. Mr. Morris's company bought a motorhome. It was used by Mr. Morris as an office, partly because Mr. Morris was disabled and he was unable to climb up the stairs to the firm's actual office, and therefore he used the motorhome as an office for quite long periods. he had the occasional weekend of use in it for the purpose for which it was designed, namely a motorhome. He argued that this was not a car, and therefore it shouldn't have a benefit in kind. Unfortunately, although it wasn't a conventional car, it was held to fit within the definition of a car. And it got worse, because although he'd only had one or two weekends of use, that doesn't matter. Any private use at all triggers a full year's benefit charge. Having had a look at a few car matters, let me move on to have a look at one or two share issues. Firstly, the problem about employment-related securities. What happens where there are founder shares, where somebody who is going to work for a new company subscribes to some founder shares? Can it be said that these are issued by reason of an individual's employment? Well, in most cases, the answer is yes, because where the company is or is about to become the individual's employer and the shares are issued, then these will be employment-related securities. The only time you might have to escape the employment-related securities definition is where the company is actually being formed. If somebody applies for shares as part of formation of a company, you can't really say that the company is about to become the employer because the company hasn't even been formed yet. You're just going through the motions of forming it. And in those circumstances, it won't be possible to say that they are caught by this rule, and therefore they will not be employment-related securities. This is important because if they are not employment-related securities, then the ordinary capital gains tax rules will apply. What about share plans? Well, a case that came to light recently shows that it may be possible to get some tax advantages by having a deferred share plan. This is where the employees have to pay full price for the shares. So there's no benefit in the terms of the price, but the payment is on deferred terms. And possibly, payment doesn't have to be made until an exit takes place, in other words, the shares are sold. Does that work? Yes, it does. An increase in the value of shares that are bought on those terms will normally not be regarded as a gain on employment-related security. It'll purely be within the capital gains tax rules, so there won't be any income tax or NIC. Unfortunately, there will be a tax charge in most cases because the payment is left deferred, and these will be treated as restricted securities. And if that happens, the whole thing is treated as a loan, and therefore there will be a potential income tax charge under the notional loans rules. A case where some shares were sold at what at first sight seemed like market value, but it turned out wasn't, came out rather badly for the employee. This is a case about an employee who worked for a company, and he subscribed for some shares in the company under a subscription agreement. Now, under this subscription agreement, he was able to get a substantial amount for his shares if they were disposed of to a third party. And in due course, they were. So the question arose, were these employment-related securities under the very wide definition? And the question there arose, were they sold at market value? Well, the individual said he'd simply gone into an agreement to subscribe for shares on normal market terms, and therefore they were sold at market value. But unfortunately, the commissioner said no, they were sold at something in excess of market value, therefore they were employment-related securities, therefore the income tax charge applied. Let me move on to some issues that arise because of the introduction of the age discrimination laws and the way these may impact on employee share plans. Let's have a look at some of the things that need to be watched for. Firstly, if the plan is discretionary and awards tend to be made to directors or senior managers, this is going to look like age discrimination. Similarly, if employees close to retirement are excluded, if shares are forfeited on early retirement, if there's a specified retirement age which is above the normal statutory age, or if there are service qualifications and therefore early leavers don't do as well. Now, in all of these cases, there may be a genuine commercial reason for the restriction, and if so, that's okay. But the difficulty may be in arguing that there is a genuine commercial reason, because if there isn't, then you're going to fall foul of the age discrimination rules. Next, the question of whether dividends which are paid out to individuals who are working for the company could be treated as taxable under the employment-related securities rules. The point here is that many companies do pay out most of their profits as dividends. And of course, many of their shareholders are also employees. Does this simply mean that these could be regarded as employment-related securities and therefore the dividends could be treated as arising from employment-related securities, therefore liable to tax as employment income? Well, the revenue given some reassurance on this. they've said no, this won't apply provided there is no specific scheme or arrangement to avoid tax on national insurance. The sort of scheme you might fall foul of here will be what's often called an alphabet shares scheme, where each employee has shares geared up to a different letter of the alphabet and receives a dividend equal to the amount they would have received as remuneration. That probably will be caught. That brings me to the end of share matters. Let's then move on to some pension topics. Well, while company pension schemes are important, it's worth looking at the background as to what the state pension scheme is doing. And it's worth mentioning that the new Pensions Act received royal assent in July 2007. One or two of its principles do impact on company pension schemes. For example, the number of years for which pension contributions must be paid to get a full basic state pension comes down from 2010 onward. At the moment, it's going to be typically 39 or 44 years for women or men, but it's going down to 30 years for all employees once we get beyond April 2010. There'll be an element of simplification. The link with earnings, we're told, is going to be restored. And, perhaps more importantly here again, the state pension age is going to be increased up to 68. So this will impact on the provisions that employees need to make in terms of their employer's pension scheme. Not a very common trend at the moment is employers wishing to get away from final salary schemes and move over to money purchase schemes. What happens if an employer gives a cash inducement to a pension member to move away from perhaps a final salary to a money purchase scheme? Well, this may be either where there's a reduction in benefits, for example, so that no further final salary benefits accrue after a certain date, or whether it's a full-scale transfer from a defined benefit final salary to a defined contribution scheme. If an inducement is paid to take that sort of transfer and it's paid in cash to the employee, then the revenue you've now confirmed it will be treated as being earnings for national insurance purposes and indeed income tax purposes. So there has been some doubt about that, but the revenue have clarified their view that it's always going to be taxable. Completely different considerations, of course, will apply where the employer, in order to persuade the employees to make the switch, actually puts money into the pension plan, simply boosts up the value of the benefits. That will have no immediate income tax implication. Next, the important change that came in post-A-Day, A-Day, of course, being the 6th of April 2007, when the major changes to pension schemes came into force. This is a rather unfortunate effect of the A-Day rules, which says that where you've got a retired employee and benefits are received, those in future must be reported and tax must be paid on them. Previously, these retirement benefits to former employees weren't picked up. Now, there is a de minimis figure of £100 per annum, but once it gets beyond that, they've got to be reported and tax paid on them. The area where it's causing most difficulty is in terms of medical insurance. Many companies, for example banks, pay BUPA subscriptions for retired bank managers. They've traditionally not been taxable, but from April 07, they are. Next, a bank that got into difficulty over the cancellation of a benefit that they'd previously given its retired employees. What happened here is that Barclays Bank used to do a free tax return preparation service for its retired employees. As a result of a reorganisation at Barclays, they were no longer in a position to do this. So they had to withdraw the service, and they went to their employees and gave them a cash lump sum to compensate them for no longer having the benefit. Now, that cash lump sum depended not on the length of service or seniority of the employee, but on the complexity of the tax return. If they'd had a complex tax return, they'd get a big tax payment, cash payment. If it was minor, not very much. So the question arose, was this cash taxable benefit? Originally, the commissioner said it wasn't, but when it went up to the court said it was a non-approved retirement benefit scheme, and the employees had to pay tax on it. That takes me to the end of those particular benefits in terms of pension schemes. Let me now move on to an area of other employee benefits. The first benefit I want to highlight in this section is late night taxis home. There's always been a concession on late night taxis home where employees have to work late, but that has now been examined by the Revenue in some detail and some final guidance on it has recently been published. What the rules say is that where an employee is required to work later than usual, and notice there must be no pattern, must be later than usual, and the employer pays for a taxi home, And provided that doesn't happen more than 60 times a year, then the benefit of a taxi home will not be a taxable benefit. What the Revenue said is that they're now looking for more documentary evidence to prove what was going on. The Revenue have accepted that a self-certification regime will be perfectly okay, so long as that self-certification regime is capable of being audited if there's a tax inquiry. They've accepted that advance approval by, for example, a senior manager won't be necessary. Perhaps the most contentious aspect of this is when it is regarded as unreasonable for the employee to take public transport. And it's normally been understood that this would apply where, for example, public transport was very irregular, the employee had to go to an unmanned station in the dark, and so on. But the Revenue have said that they're not so sure about this, and that that in itself may not make it unreasonable to take public transport. So there could be some disputes coming up here. Next, a notification from the Revenue about salary sacrifices and staff canteens. Normally, if you make a salary sacrifice and get a tax-free benefit, that will work okay. But it's got to be a true long-term sacrifice. There must be true separation between the employee and the particular money that's been sacrificed. And turn it round the other way, if the employee controls the spending, it won't be a genuine sacrifice. The issue that's arisen here has been with staff canteens. What happens if food purchased is chargeable? And there may be two situations here. Firstly, the employer meets the employee's liability. This will be where, for example, the employer goes along in the staff canteen, pushes his tray to the till, is told how much he owes, and then says, I'll take a salary sacrifice for that much. In that case, the employee is liable and simply takes a salary sacrifice to eliminate it. That will not be valid. The other possibility is where the employer provides credit. At the end of the month, for example, the employer tells the employee he's run up canteen bills of £50 or whatever, and the employee simply says, I'll sacrifice salary of £50. Again, that won't do. The employer is providing credit. It must be a true long-term sacrifice, for example, done year by year. Next, some interesting notes about job-related living accommodation. It's often a difficult area, and the Revenue have come up with some notes which make interesting reading and give some useful guidance as to when this concession will apply. The Revenue have got particularly interested about the status of pub managers here. Okay, let's say what the rules are. There are three possible areas where job-related accommodation won't give a benefit in kind. Firstly, is the accommodation necessary for the performance of the duties? The Revenue give examples here, like, for example, the level crossing keeper who has to live in the level crossing keeper's cottage. Next one is a two-stage one. Is it provided for the better performance of the duties and is customary? And certainly an example might be a policeman, a minister of religion, a prison officer, and so on. The third one, which isn't mentioned here, is where there's a security risk. In terms of pub managers, the Revenue say that they've actually moved from one category to the other. They say that under previous licensing law, it was necessary, mostly anyway, for pub managers to live on the pub. They don't think it's necessary anymore, but they accept it's for the better performance and customary. Let's move on now to a holiday pay scheme. The issue here is difficulties in the construction industry. In the construction industry, employees have tended to move from site to site, from employer to employer. What happens then when it's holiday time? Well, the snag here would be that you might not have been working for the current employer for very long when you want to take your holiday. So it's been solved by a holiday pay scheme, where each employer chipped into the holiday pay scheme, and when the employee went on holiday, he simply drew the money out of the scheme. The advantage of that is that a withdrawal from a holiday pay scheme was not liable to NI, whereas a payment by the employer would be. Unfortunately, a number of other employers have tried to get in on the act here, and so the Revenue have decided to close it down. In the case of where it's not construction industry, who it was originally meant for, the rule comes in straight away from October 07. For the construction industry, and that of course is the industry that it was originally meant for in the first place, they've got 5 years to get things sorted out, and they won't be hit by the withdrawal of the scheme until 2012. Next, some new rules on medical checkups. The general assumption has been that medical checkups just simply weren't liable as a benefit in kind. Revenue have tightened up a little bit on that, and there are some new rules coming in. Two areas here. Firstly, what happens if there's a health screening? Well, the answer is provided that's available to all employees, then it won't be a benefit in kind. What about medical checkup? Well, the answer is again, provided it's all employees, it'll be okay. So it must either be available to all employees or available to the all employees who are identified by a screening as needing a checkup. Next, a fallout from the change in April 06 about computers provided by an employer. You'll remember that up till April 06, a computer provided for private use, there was no tax benefit in kind, provided the computer was worth less than $2,500. What about a BlackBerry? Well, pre-April 06, it didn't matter about having a discussion whether a BlackBerry was a computer or not. If it was a computer, well, there was no benefit in kind anyway. But of course, it's now important. And generally, the revenue do feel that a BlackBerry is a computer. And if it's a computer, then if you get a BlackBerry, you've got a benefit in kind charge. Well, you have. The only exception may be where the use of the computer, or in this case the BlackBerry, is incidental to the main use of it for business purposes. So the question then arises, if you get a few private messages and so on, is that significant private use that would take you out of these rules? For example, it's generally reckoned that if private use is relatively small and you've got to use the thing, then you won't be caught. If you are caught, then the benefit in kind charge, of course, is 20% of the market value. The revenue have given some helpful guidance on when they think private use of a computer will be insignificant, and it's set out in their employment income manual. What they do say is that you won't need detailed records. They'll look at each case on its merits. So, for example, they will decide based on the amount of time spent, and perhaps more crucially, is it necessary to have the computer to carry out the duties? If you can't carry out the duties without the computer provided by the employer, then it's very unlikely they'll say that any private use is anything other than insignificant. And it'll be important to look at the employer's policy and see what that is on private use. Next, some arguments that came up a year or two ago about tips and tronks. In what circumstances will tips be liable to NI if they're paid through a tronk, that is a pooling system where all the tips in a restaurant or hotel are pooled together? Well, the important thing here is that tips that go out through a tronk are only NI free if either the allocation isn't determined by the employer or the employer doesn't actually handle the money. Now, in many cases, the employer will perhaps handle the money because there'll be credit card payments. So the crucial thing is to show the employer doesn't allocate the gratuities. So it's a good idea to make sure that a company director, if it is a restaurant company, isn't also the tronc master, because it's difficult to show the employer didn't allocate. Or equally, to show that an associate or relative of a director of the restaurant doesn't get involved in allocating it. But if that's the case, then that normally will be okay. For example, it's perfectly okay to use the employer's payroll to deal with the pay-as-you-earn aspect of the tronc, provided the employer doesn't actually allocate the payments. Another important point to mention is if there is a right to receive the tips, NIC will apply. This may often happen where the employee is told that he will get at least pounds X a week in terms of tips, or so much an hour in terms of tips. If that's guaranteed, NIC will apply. Next, an important salary sacrifice matter in terms of tax credits and childcare vouchers. It's now possible to give up to £55 a week in childcare vouchers, and they're completely free of income tax and national insurance. Therefore, is it a good idea for an employee who's got children to sacrifice £55 a week of salary and take the vouchers instead? Well, in most cases, the answer is yes, it will be better to do that. But there will be difficulties where perhaps at the relatively low pay level, you're actually getting child tax credit, which is based on your childcare costs. And obviously, if your childcare costs fall because of the vouchers, your child credit will fall. So yes, you could be worse off in some circumstances. And the Revenue have published some guidance on this. For example, if your eligible childcare costs are more than £175 a week for one child, then you'll always be better off having the vouchers because you'll be above the limit at which they start to do the calculation. So it's worth having a look at these rules to make sure that we don't actually have a salary sacrifice scheme that makes things worse for the employee. Next, an issue about Christmas parties and P11Ds. It's reasonably well known that there's a cap of £150, that if the benefit is less than £150 of a Christmas party, there won't be a P11D benefit. One or two issues here. The £150 allowance is per guest, not per employee. So if each employee can bring a husband or wife or partner, it's £150 per guest. If the cost exceeds 150, the whole lot's taxable. It's a cliff edge effect. But the employee can bring it down by paying the excess. So if it costs 160, the employee pays £10, 150 will be tax-free. Can you have multiple parties? Yes, you can. If you've got multiple parties, you can pick and choose. And if you get a combination less than 150, you're okay. And what about that? Well, you can recover VAT on staff entertaining. You can't recover VAT, though, on entertaining the husbands or wives or partners of staff. But if these people pay a sum of money to be entertained, and it's more than just a derisory de minimis amount, that will make all the VAT recoverable. That brings me to the end of the other benefits, and I'd like to finish off by having a look at one or two issues that arise from employee termination payments. Firstly, a question about whether a payment on termination of employment can qualify for the £30,000 tax-free Golden Handshake payment allowance. The Brander case was one where a payment was made to the directors. Was it tax-free or was the first £30,000 tax-free? Well, in this case, the directors were invited to resign, but they were told that if they didn't resign, they'd be sacked. And they were given 12 months' salary, holiday pay, and also some compensation for loss of various other rights. Was this payment taxable, and if so, how? Well, it was held that it was not taxable as ordinary employment income, because in effect they'd been fired. Therefore, it was taxable under Section 148. Section 148 says that the first £30,000 is tax-free and only the balance is taxable. Next, the SCA packaging case. The SCA packaging case, a number of employees were fired from the company. And the question here arose, was the Golden Handshake payment they got, which is in effect payment in lieu of notice, was this payment arising from the contract of employment or not? Well, if you start by looking at the wording of the contract of employment, that just simply gave entitlement to notice, but there was no mention at all of a possible payment in lieu of notice. So on the face of it, it looked as though it didn't arise under the contract. The snag was, there was a separate memorandum that amplified the contract, and this separate memorandum did say that there would be a payment in lieu of notice if somebody was fired without notice. And unfortunately, putting the two together constituted a single contract, and therefore it was held that the contract did provide for payment in lieu of notice, and therefore the payment in lieu of notice was fully taxable. Next, let's have a look at what happens where you're in the run-up to retirement or the payments made on death. Now, the rule has generally been there's no such thing as a first £30,000 tax-free where you're leaving on retirement or it's payment on death. There used to be a rule, which was blown away at Hayday on the 6th of April 2006, that said that it was possible to have a payment in these circumstances if it was below certain de minimis rules. And these de minimis rules looked at the pension scheme rules, the old style pension scheme rules. Well, they've all gone. And so now it just isn't going to be possible. So what happens now? If a lump sum payment is made without any relevant pension being paid by the pension scheme, it'll simply be treated as unauthorised payment and a tax charge will be levied. If, on the other hand, the employer simply makes an ex-gratia payment on retirement or death, then it'll be treated as an employer-financed retirement benefits payment, and that will almost certainly be unauthorised, and therefore tax will be fully payable. That brings me to the end of the employee benefits update.